participation and ideas. We ask only that you be prepared to challenge conventional wisdom. And, of course, we're heard Monday through Thursday here from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Thursday at 99.5 FM in New York. My engineer this afternoon is Maria Englund. Good afternoon, Maria.
Good afternoon, Hugh.
How do you do?
I'm fine, thank you.
Oh, good. How has your day been so far? I see that you appear to be womaning the board.
Well, it's been good. I've been doing some engineering with the help of my dear friend Michael G. Haskins, who has left me here all alone, but now I'm here with Paul Williams, who's sort of assisting me, so I think I'm going to be fine.
Is this a good internship, you think?
It is. I'm enjoying myself. I've learned a lot, so it's a great internship.
Now, you are returning to Stockholm shortly.
Yeah, in a month.
In a month?
Yes.
Will you return to us?
You'll never know. I might. Not get rid of me that easy.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Marie. It's 2 minutes after 3 o'clock, and this is Talk Back. I'm Hugh Hamilton, and today we get into the second of the second day in a consecutive series of discussions, conversations, that I shall be having with Utrecht Lead, who is also our general manager here at the radio station. Now, after yesterday's program, I did receive several calls, and I want to clarify a few things. First of all, I mentioned a moment ago that we're talking with Utrecht Lead, who is also our general manager. It does not mean that that is the single and the most defining aspect of her personality and her being. I say that because there are some people who seem to feel that the only questions that can properly be addressed to her are questions that deal with her relationship with this radio station. That is, in fact, not true. In fact, the reason that I decided to have her on is because of the multifaceted nature of her work over the years, and the fact that she is a person of substantial breadth and depth of experience in a variety of areas, and expertise also in a variety of areas. And so our conversations will be probing various and sundry aspects of her experience and expertise, and in the course of our conversations, I would expect that those of you who are already calling, for that matter, and I don't know why you're calling yet, because we have not even announced what is going to be the nature of our discussion this afternoon, but for those of you who will be calling, I would expect that you would take advantage of this unique opportunity to engage in a discussion, an intellectual discourse, if you will, with someone who has distinguished herself in a number of areas and various disciplines and fields, and someone whose perspectives you have shared in this segment of our broadcast day, and who I am very privileged to succeed in this time slot. Anyway, we'll get back to our discussion with Utrecht Lead, which we started yesterday. This is a discussion that takes place under the general umbrella of the battle for the mind, and we'll get back to that a little later on this afternoon, in fact in about 5 or 6, maybe 7 minutes or thereabouts. I'm going to define for you what is going to be the thrust of our discussion this afternoon, right after we return from a musical break, which of course is customary, as you know, an immediate break we call this, in the Talk Back format. So at 5 minutes now after 3 o'clock, take a break. By the way, the telephone number is 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. Make a note of it and call your family and friends and let them know. The Talk Back is on the air, and I'm here with you until 5 o'clock this afternoon. We'll be right back.
from the ghetto. life of misery and regret. No one to come to their rescue except Cable Pond and Buju. For so their boombox is gonna go. So drum out voices from the ghetto.
The music of Singing Sandra there, 12 Voices from the Ghetto, and that's from the compact disc Caribbean Divas, Divas, whatever
Divas,
they are. Divas.
Divas,
yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Divers would have an E.
Would have an E.
Yes.
Okay,
and an
great.
R.
And, oh, and an R also.
Yeah.
From Rituals Music. That has an R. Rituals,
yeah,
Music.
Right.
My guest this afternoon for the second consecutive day of our conversations is Eutrice C. Lead, who is, among other things, inter alia, our general manager here at the radio station. But she's also a woman of considerable distinction in the field of journalism and also in the field of advocacy.
And cooking.
And, oh, well, we haven't gotten to that yet. That's for another program. Maybe we'll deal with that tomorrow.
Cooking.
And so, Eutrice, I'm happy to welcome you back
Thank
to this segment
very
of
much,
our broadcast day here on Talkback.
Thank you so much.
Okay, great. Our telephone number, by the way, 212-209-2900. Here's where I'd like us to go this afternoon. I want us to dissect, if you will, an understanding of media. And here I talk about print as well as broadcast media. And here's why. During the course of my tenure in this time slot, I have been told many times by callers that one of the things you did was that you instructed listeners in how to read a news story,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was particularly profound because this is, of course, one of the classes that you conducted when you and I worked at the City Sun in how to understand what is there, what is not there, what is not being said, what questions are not being asked. And we worked for what generally was described at that time as alternative media.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always wondered, alternative to what?
Alternative to what there is. And what there is a very broad but shallow pool of mediocrity. And because we worked in the black press and because I view the black press as perhaps the greatest civilizing agent in the United States. The black press, I think, has saved the soul of America.
Those are broad statements.
Yes, it is, and a profound one, I think, too, because it was through the black press and through the agitation of the black press that America consistently had to come to grips with this permanent flaw in society called racism. I call it race oppression because people have militarized around race practices, racial practices. The black press, contrary to what people believe is just a different expression and they attach cultural significance to it, it is actually intellectual significance to the black press. The way it started. The black press grew out of a crucible of affirmation by people consistently locked out of the general arenas of discourse and debate. A unique informational need, not only as a way of communicating to and among or encouraging communication among people who were oppressed in this country, but providing instruction and a paradigm for alternative action so that when you think differently, you act differently, and there's a direct correlation to it. There is an A equal to B, B equal to C idea here. If you have sound information, you make more intelligent choices. And if you make more intelligent choices, you tend to act. You are better equipped to navigate your day-to-day lives much more easily, much more capably. And that was what the founders of the Black Press saw. And this is why I find myself staying with the Black Press and with alternative media, because that was where the activism in America was born. Black people, the blacks who founded the press, Russ Worm and Cornish founding Freedom's Journal, people like Frederick Douglass, and there's a long list of luminaries, Ida B. Wells, and many, many others. They were consistently drawn to this business of education through media, because that was how you literally change people's lives. You change their capacity to think and appreciate alternative ways of thinking. And I found it necessary. Even, I started a journalism training program, which was rated the best program in the state of New York for all the years that it existed, because you take unorthodox approaches. This thing we call media is really perhaps more pronounced exercise in inquiry, but it still is about inquiry. You have to seek out the truth, and the truth being relative to a number of things, but you have to seek out, when I use the word truth, I mean as many different sources of information as you possibly can present, authoritatively researched, carefully researched, so that the ultimate decision is being made by the consumer of that information. And that is when we do our jobs the best. Now, I've had a great privilege, and I founded and helped found, I should say, a wire service, a black wire service. I worked in the newspaper business for quite some time. I trained people in the newspaper business, and I've worked in radio and television. So I have a broad range of experiences with media. The bottom line still is the same. It's a human element that is involved. And every step of the way, you have to keep in mind that you are not the information. You are simply the facilitator of information. If you do your job well, that's what you do. You facilitate the exchange of information, keeping yourself out of it as much as possible, but concentrating on the role of facilitating the transmission of information.
Is there a black or alternative perspective to every story? Let's take a story like global warming, for example.
Yes.
If you're working with the, quote, alternative media, and I use this term advisedly, you have been referring, of course, to the black press. And with all due respect to the history and role of the black press, we also do have a proliferation of alternative media representing other ethnic and racial viewpoints and language viewpoints. We've got Korean media, Chinese media, you know, generally Asian, Indian media, and so on and so forth. And I don't know whether in your employment of the term you are also embracing all of these, quote, alternative viewpoints.
Yes.
Are you?
Yes, I am. And I think they're viable because, again, this is the key to oppression. The key to oppression is the denial of information. And each of these groups, in one form or the other, has experienced the same thing, of being locked out of the arenas of discourse and debate. And they have had, this is what Dr. Rashmi Mayur, here on WBAI, his program Voices from the South, this is why he is here. There's a whole range of views that must be presented from the people experiencing those things. And the time has come to not to allow, because allowing people is still an exercise of power. The time has come simply to make room for those voices. You ask whether there is a black view or a different view on a particular story. The answer is yes. I remember you doing one of the seminal pieces that still stands today when you were at the City Sun on environmental racism in Harlem. All right? Now, people have been discussing environmental racism all the time, but you devoted, what was it, 36 pages?
36 pages.
36 pages. Now, this is what I mean. Nobody felt it important enough to devote 36 pages to this one issue. And that was not the whole paper. It was just an insert to the newspaper. And I could tell you right now, that piece that you did still stands as the necessary reference point in the environmental struggle on articulating the impact of these nebulous and amorphous terms. What does it mean to live in a place like Harlem? And you did this when 1980 something. And it still stands today. And that's what I'm saying. When you take a view from the place where the impact is felt the greatest, you are necessarily taking a different point of view, because the people who are telling stories are still telling our experiences for us. The information is second and third hand because they are not organically linked to our communities, and therefore their access is limited. But their cultural imperialism gets in the way. They will not allow the people themselves to be key actors in their own dramas. They insist on the right of translating people's experiences, and that's what they call journalism. I differ with that.
Now, just let me ask you this, since you raised that particular question. When I came to the City Sun, where you were at the time, the managing editor, I was told it's a black newspaper. However, when I got there, I realized that of the entire staff, I would say at least 40% of the people were white, which led me to believe, as a recent immigrant at that time in the mid-80s, led me to question, do you have to be black to work with a black newspaper? The photographer, by the way, Peter Essick, who is an internationally renowned photographer and is in fact on the staff of the National Geographic.
That's right.
And who is white and who is from Burbank, California, a white guy.
Armenian.
And Armenian, and with whom I worked on that story, and
yes.
He and I worked on several others.
Yes.
There were several other white reporters,
yes.
White photographers. So the question then becomes, do you have to be black to recognize a black perspective or in working for a black publication or for black media, whether it's radio, television, or print?
A large number of the people who worked at the City Sun were not African. You remember we had Pakistanis, we had people from all over the place working at the paper. In fact, my journalism training program, the same thing. Very, very key, though, is a consciousness about what we are there to do. We are there to provide information to an informationally disfranchised community. You have to sign on to that in order to participate. You don't sign on to that, you don't have to participate. I couldn't care whether you were yellow, blue, green, or purple. I'm interested in the integrity of your work. And I'm not asking permission from anybody to head up an enterprise. I am heading it up. There's a chain of command that is established. We operate, as you experienced, we operate in a fairly democratic fashion. Everybody understands what role he or she is supposed to fulfill. You go and fulfill your role. You recall we'd have a staff meeting. And at that staff meeting, we'll discuss what it is people propose to put into the paper that coming week. And after that, I couldn't care less how you did your story. You know, you want to come in, fine. You don't want to come in, fine. But your deadline day is your deadline day. 1 minute after deadline, I own you.
Indeed.
You're mine. You're mine. 1 minute after deadline, you're mine. You can do anything. You want to type with your thumbs, fine. You want to type with your butt, fine. 1 minute after deadline time, we have a difficulty. And at that time, I will do what I have to do. Friend or foe, it doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is that we all understand the rules. We have a set of rules, and we all abide by them. It makes life so much simpler. But that's also an important thing. What made that work was the level of maturity. People came to their positions as mature people, embracing responsibility, and also recognizing that they have something to contribute. They take it seriously. We are very much of service to the community informationally. We are interested in serving this community. In the meantime, we will train people, as we are now. Maria, who is engineering, is being trained. Brother Shine is training. Carletta Joy Walker is training. You have to pass the information on. You don't hold on to it like you've got a monopoly on it. No, you pass it on. That's what you're here for. You are a link in a long chain. And if you do not strengthen your link in that chain, you make the whole chain useless. You make it weak. So you pass on the information. And that is why the onus is on you to perfect your skills. You cannot underperform. You have to give the best you can. You have to work harder and harder at perfecting your skills, because it's not about you. You are truly a transmitter. You are a transmitter of information to the outside world, and you are supposed to be, if you're in the business of activism, you are a transmitter of skills to the next generation. So you have a lot of work to do as a reporter. You can't be an airhead and be in this business. A lot of people are. They don't read. They do not have a full comprehension of things. They do not see the world in its complexity. They do not have an understanding of the systems of the world and how they are interconnected. And therefore, they can't really pull stories out unless they are spelled out in black and white. They are not able easily to navigate these complex systems. And that's training, too. That's really what you need as a journalist. You need to have an eye for the stories that are not being told. So when you ask these questions about, do you have to be black? No, you don't have to be black. But it helps a hell of a lot when you are.
Why?
Because you come with a leg up to this issue. If you are telling the stories, or you're in the business of transmitting the stories of a particular constituency, having an organic link to it is a great advantage. It doesn't mean that only you can tell that story, but it means that you have a great advantage. And in the world in which we live, I'll let you know that there are stories that you and I and others, because of our packaging, never will be permitted to tell, which is why WBAI is so very important. We will not be permitted to tell these stories because it has been decided that these areas are off limits to people like you and me. In fact, I was just reading in a newspaper just yesterday. Well, in fact, Earl Caldwell addressed this question about the Daily News, a paper in this town that has a dubious distinction of being convicted in a federal court of racism. By the way, one of the columnists of the Daily News is leading an anti-Pacifica campaign, but I guess we'll talk about that later. But
in due course. We're talking, of course, about Mr. Gonzalez.
Well, I will call him Juan.
Okay.
Okay. He's an employee of the Daily News, owned by Mort Zuckerman. Do you know the first thing that happened there was that the editorial room literally was swept clean of all black men in it?
As I recall, years ago, in the 1980s, there was a lawsuit
Yes.
In which
we covered that at the City Sun.
Yes, indeed.
City Sun was the only paper that consistently covered that case because it was a landmark case.
What was the issue there?
Six reporters, more than them really, but the six litigated in behalf of a class of African Americans at the Daily News who systematically were denied their just due. The Daily News was a bastion of whiteness, and the paper saw to it in a systematic way. All of the papers did. The New York Times has its own troubles right now, but the Daily News, which was considered a liberal paper, may I say, again, systematically discriminated against its African-American employees, denying them certain assignments, denying them certain responsibilities, denying them promotions and so forth, and commensurate salaries and so forth. And the Daily News was found guilty. They actually litigated this case rather than come to terms. They decided that they were so powerful, they will litigate. And a court convicted them. A jury convicted them of trenchant racism. What do I read in yesterday's papers? I'll just read you an excerpt. When Mort Zuckerman dispensed his axemen to U.S. News and World Report, he also owns that, in an effort to revive the faltering weekly magazine, he also decimated the ranks of minority writers on the staff by 50%.
Mm-hmm.
Now listen to what we're discussing here. Two of the 21 people fired were African Americans, and they're named here. It goes on. One of the writers, a person by the name of Jeannie Thornton, had been editing a quarterly newsletter that was sent to high school guidance counselors, but the newsletter fell victim to the axe, and so did she in the recent downsizing that cut about 21 editorial side staffers. That reduces the African Americans on the 200 plus person editorial staff to two people, under 1%. They are Terry Samuel, the congressional correspondent, and Kenneth Terrell, who covers technology. Now, here's the thing. Like a lot of newsrooms, we're not the greatest at recruiting minorities, said U.S. News editor Brian Duffy, who last month replaced Steve Smith at the helm of Zuckerman's Weekly. It's not a perfect world. We do the best we can.
Which I know that you're jumping at the bit to go on this, but I've got a question that this raises, and that is, ever so often we hear about. I'm assuming that you would assume that the Daily News is part of the quote mainstream media,
yes,
as opposed to alternative media.
Yes, it is.
Okay, now here's my question though. We often get involved in this mathematical dilemma where we say, you know, blacks are X percent, but they're only Y percent of this. Asians are you know, A percent, but they are disproportionately represented among, well, you know, whatever group of people, and so on and so forth. Should we be involved in a discussion that attempts some kind of proportional representation in every facet of public or private or professional life,
look,
including the media?
When we take a look at the media, and this is one of the barometers by which we measure so-called progress and the so-called progressive community, it is still clear that nationally, people of color are less than 1% of the total editorial staffs in this nation, which means we are not involved in the generation of information about world affairs, about local issues, about health, about culture. And we are discussed, and our issues are discussed by proxy, by people who have no organic link at all with us. We are, for some reason, feared in the world of media. So our involvement is exceedingly limited. And I raise this for a second reason. The leader of this anti-Pacifica campaign, Juan Gonzalez, who works for the Daily News, he is an employee of the Daily News, has not seen fit. Now, he is a byproduct of so-called equal opportunity. He came into this realm on the backs of black people who struggled. And this I talked about yesterday. This colonization of the mind affects everybody. Smack in the middle of racist thinking, when you have the editor of U.S. News and World Report, a very major international magazine, the editor saying, look, it's not a perfect world, and we do the best we can, and hey, you know, tough noogies. That is unacceptable in today's world. That is unacceptable in a city that looks like this. That is unacceptable, especially given the fact that we have talent. We have people available. We have people who've been doing this. We have people who are eminently qualified. That story is not going to be told, and certainly it will not be told by Juan Gonzalez at the Daily News. The racist newspaper, it would not be told there. Nobody would be permitted to tell that story there. But they can talk about WBAI, and they can talk about Pacifica at will. But this is the struggle. Who is in charge of telling the world about the struggles of the world largely emanating from communities and countries of color? Who's in charge of that? You know, the feminists just had their national convention, and Marjorie Moore talked with me about that this morning. Marsha Ann Gillespie, who I respect enormously, who was an editor-in-chief of Ms. Magazine, and who put Essence Magazine on the map. She's a very brilliant woman. Talked that in this international gathering of women, only one voice belonging to a Latina was raised, decrying racism within the ranks. And had she not been there, Marsha Gillespie wrote, had this woman not been invited, the subject would never have come up. This is what's going on in media. People of color are consigned to be window dressing. The order of things is that that's the role they ought to play. On television, everybody's so airbrushed, you know. I'm still waiting to see, even on black-owned television, I'm waiting to see a black person. Everybody's airbrushed with flowing hair. We are still strung out about this business of color and race. And we will not admit that that is the issue. We will not admit that there are writers who have black skin, but you will write about Harlem and Bed-Stuy and hip-hop until you die. You will not write about world affairs. You will not write about the African Union that is being formed. You will not write about the relationship between world lending institutions and the constriction of opportunity in certain countries. You will not write things that require intellectual, true intellectual pursuit and analysis. You are there to entertain. And progressives subscribe to this view. You know how many progressive media institutions still believe that black people are supposed to be doing ha-ha, hee-hee, ho-ho, you laugh a lot, and you entertain. But when you start talking about serious issues, oh, no, 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 that, you, now you're treading in my ground. I will write you a memo telling you, you dare not discuss this. Not until I give you permission. How dare you discuss this subject? I have done it. I own it. This is my space. No, no, no. In progressive institutions, it's still a question of when is it appropriate for you? Who gives you permission to be intellectual? You have to be given permission to do that. I defy that. I say no. The time has come, and under my stewardship, I would insist on that truly liberated, truly progressive people deal with this question and make room, because they'll have to. Make room. There are voices out there with stories to tell. There's information out there to be shared. And that is why during the drive I was so pleased. All of these wonderful voices, not just belonging to people of color, but people who are liberated from this moronic way of thinking, this archaic way of thinking. Information is about information. And if you're truly progressive, if you're truly immersed in this question of activism, you do the work of understanding that there's a change. And the change is also intellectual in nature. The demographics have changed, and the intellectual offerings also must change. The agents of information must change. The nature of information must change, because that is the demand, that is the reality. I had an interview with someone who says he's a media writer. And he says, well, what about gay programming? I mean, we were talking about the programming effort at WBAI, and I was insisting that, you know, it's changing. The demographics have changed. Well, you have gay programming, he said. I said, yeah, and?
Mm-hmm. What was the point he was trying to make then?
I have no idea. I could only surmise that, in his view, that pretty much satisfies diversity. You know, but a lot of people are into the... I love it, you know. Growing up the way I have, and growing up in my background, the people are going to tell me what diversity is all about. I've been living diversity. I don't talk about it. I've lived it. It's part of the natural way in which I live. It's part of my cultural background. Diversity. When you look at this face, you are looking at diversity.
That diversity.
That's right. Okay. And, you know, this is a new thing some people have discovered. So now they have to also tinker with it, because on the one hand, they have to be politically correct and uphold the tenets of diversity. But intellectually, they're not prepared to let go. So they have to disguise the lust for power and control. Yeah, okay. What we'll do is we'll put in, okay, you're gay, so you're in. Okay, you're a Latino, okay. No. We have a whole different response. The response today is, if you are doing a program dealing with the gay community, you have to recognize that that community too has changed. And that's the beauty of the gay programming here. They've recognized that that community has changed. And they look like New York looks. And they're working at it. So when we talk about gay issues, we are no longer talking about gay as defined 10 years ago or 20 years ago as predominantly white and male. The gay world does not look like that in New York and Connecticut and New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and the world. It has changed. So, change with it. Deal with it.
When we return, by the way, we're talking with Utrecht Lead, who is also the general manager here at WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, to which you are now listening. I'm Hugh Hamilton. And when we return, we're going to deal with this question, Utrecht. I'm going to put to you the question then, when we return. Do all media have a responsibility in some way to reflect this, quote, to use your word, diversity, unquote, of the constituency who support them? And by this I mean, we're talking about newspapers, radio stations, you know, wherever. We here at WBAI, we've got, as you said, gay programming. We've got, but how far do you take that?
Mm-hmm.
Do you go to Lithuanian programming, programming from Tajikistan, programming? Can only people from the Congo report on the Congo? We're not going to do that right now.
I guess you're attacking my wonderful idea, cooking with power tools.
Well, when we return, we'll get to that. But first, we'll take a break. It's 47 minutes after the hour. Our telephone number is 212-209-2900. We're talking with you, Therese Lead. On this afternoon, we're dealing with the issue of understanding media as part of our continuing series of conversations under the general umbrella, the battle for the mind. And we'll get to your calls a little after 4 o'clock or so. I've got a couple of other things that we need to address before we get to that. But right now, we'll take a break. Here's something to liven up your Tuesday afternoon.
Oh,
It's 52 minutes after the hour. That makes it 8 minutes now before 4 o'clock, and you're listening to the Tuesday edition of the program Talk Back. This afternoon, our guest in studio is Utrice C. Lead, who is also the general manager here at WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. And this afternoon, we're talking about understanding media, part of a series of conversations we're having this week under the general umbrella, the battle for the mind. And our focus this afternoon is understanding media. Now, for those of you who would like to raise questions for Utrice Lead and who would like to participate in the discussion this afternoon, I would just like to remind you as follows. One, our telephone number, 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. Two, the issue this afternoon is understanding media. We will take your comments and questions for Utrice Lead on the question of media, understanding media, how media operate, how media are organized. Our general focus this afternoon is understanding media. I'd like you to make a note of that. Also, we'd like you to make your questions and your comments as concise as possible so that we can get the maximum benefit of Ms. Lead's presence in the studio here this afternoon as my guest. It's now 53 minutes after the hour, and we return to our conversation now. You mentioned earlier that I'm talking now to Ms. Lead. Good afternoon again, Ms. Lead.
Thank you.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that, less than a certain percent of the number of persons who are African-American are represented in the mainstream media. But now, here comes the question, though. So, too, are Nepalese, people from Bhutan, people from Burkina Faso. At what point do we arrive at a satisfactory degree of representation, not only in terms of what people look like, but what people's perspectives are? Because, after all, you can have, we did have at the City Sun a substantial number of people who were Caucasian, but they worked for a, quote, black newspaper.
Yes.
Is it, can only Nepalese report on events taking place in Nepal, or people from Burkina Faso, or from someplace in the vicinity of the African continent report on events taking place in Africa or wherever?
Well, it depends. And it depends on the consciousness of the people.
How do we measure that, though?
Well, again, the conduct is one good way. A lot of what we are fighting when we deal with media is colonialism, or cultural imperialism, I would call it. The idea still, this notion of white supremacist thinking, that there must be control over what it is that people are allowed to think. And only one group of people can have that control. The people who worked with us at the City Sun had already rid themselves of that notion, which is why they were perfectly compatible with our mission. They did great photography. They did great editorial work. And they understood that they were contributors, that they were not going to control the editorial product. They understood that. The control of the editorial product was my function, period.
But how does that relate now to the mainstream media?
Same thing. When we at a newspaper, a small newspaper, I'm interested in people who are interested in what it is we set out to accomplish as a mission. In mainstream media, the editorial thrust is far more diverse, and it is driven not by a consciousness, a political consciousness, as much as it is by commerce. And so the mainstream media takes an entirely different thrust because the bottom line is money. The Daily News, for example, earns $1 million every Sunday, strictly from people of color in this town. And I've done programs about the Daily News and its treatment of people of color in this town. The City Sun was a paper geared toward the black community, but it did not say, if you were white, if you are Italian, if you are Indian, you cannot read this paper because it's only for black people. No, it was primarily a paper. It was a paper primarily aimed at a uniquely disfranchised community, people who needed to know certain things about themselves. Whoever was able to contribute meaningfully, you were welcome. But on terms that are set. You don't just come in there and now you begin the process of undermining what it is we're trying to do. That, as you experience, that simply would not be tolerated.
But in the context of the mainstream media, though, you're welcome to participate on the terms that are set.
No, you're not.
The terms
you're
are
not
driven.
Welcome.
Oh, you're not welcome.
You're not welcome. In
okay.
May. If people of color and people with particular consciousness were welcomed in mainstream media, we would have an entirely different editorial product. In mainstream media, we don't.
But of course, we can't pretend that commerce does not drive, as you mentioned just now, that commerce drives the agenda in the mainstream media.
Yeah.
Now, even if you were in charge were in charge of mainstream media, commerce would still be the driving factor. We cannot pretend that that is not a very potent, if not the most potent force.
Right, but mainstream media is an extension of the power elite. And the power elite has one major and permanent concern, and that is control. Control of the mind. So that while it is an article of commerce, it is also serving a political purpose, which is the control of information. The controlling of information in turn controls thought. The control of thought in turn controls action. That's the combination, the lethal combination in most major media. They're articles of commerce, but they are extensions of the power elite.
We're talking with Utrecht Lead, who's general manager here at WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. It is now 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We'll go to your telephone calls in a moment at 212-209-2900. And we are talking about understanding media, part of a series of conversations in which we are discussing issues pertaining to the battle for the mind. Now, translate all of what we have discussed in this first hour to the context of WBAI. Now, WBAI is not mainstream media. What manner of animal is this?
Well, WBAI...
Is it alternative? What manner of animal is it?
The thing that is most exciting is that we are in charge of that definition. The people who are here. We're in charge of that. The people who are with us can help us also define what manner of animal we are. What kind of radio station we hope to be. More than anything else, one would hope that we are about some time-tested things like a commitment to truth.
Whose truth?
That's it. The truth of the issues that you are talking about. We cannot be absolute about truth. We know that. But we have a responsibility to present as much of what we know as possible. We have that responsibility.